Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic.
Hello, everybody. And we are here on Covenstead. And I am Danny Delisle, and I am here, as always, with my partner in crime and coven mate on this journey, Todd. Say hello, Todd.
Hello, everybody. It is I, fellow co-host, Todd Crapper. Since we're going formal and giving our full names here, actually, if that were the case, then I'd be saying this is Todd Lawrence Crapper. And that's right. In addition to having the last name Crapper, my initials are TLC.
That's good. So today we are continuing on these questions about magical systems and questions you should ask about your magical system that we found. And it generated quite the discussion. We got through 4 of the 12 last time. So it has generated lots of conversation. So I am eager to go ahead and get started. We are on question number 5. So Todd, pray tell, what is the question number 5?
Yeah, this one's tricky. Question 5, what does available magic do? And that part right there, the word available, I'm not quite sure what to make of this one. What do you think?
Available. Maybe to the people, the players or the characters, I think. Because there's magic in the world, but it's not accessible by everybody or available to everybody. Like, it can't be used by some people. So maybe that's what it's talking about, is my guess.
Yeah, almost like it implies a kind of forbidden magic out there somewhere that could be, or it could even just be kind of beyond the reach, you know. So there have been some fantasy worlds and games where magic is an everyday part of the culture, you know, like how we have it with N'Vala. Every witch in N'Vala has some use and access to magic and how they, what they do with it and how they do it. But it's also other things, too, where, like, I've actually heard one interpretation of the game Dungeon World, which is the PBTA hack of D&D, basically. I've heard one person actually phrase it, because each of their classes is known as the rogue, the fighter, the wizard. They always took it as that was the one person who had that ability, so to speak. And I liked that idea of how it almost made it the wizard to almost be more kind of Lord of the Rings style, where it's just like, you know, there's only 5 of them. Like, there's a small handful of people that could do this. So in that sense, it's not necessarily available. But yeah, so there's a bunch of different ways. So do we want to take a look at this as, kind of like, you know, if available is kind of like from a widespread societal kind of thing, because that's what we are more inclined to talk about as this particular podcast, because it's about witchcraft and Wicca and everything. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think your example of what they're talking about with availability in terms of Lord of the Rings is a good one, because not everybody is a wizard. Right. So they don't have access to the same things that Gandalf and Radagast and Saruman do. Right. I mean, they're men and they have access to like magic items, let's say, which they do. But in terms of available, there are some pieces of magic that are unavailable to people in Middle Earth. That's just the way it is. And it's not necessarily because it's forbidden. It's just certain people don't have the capacity to do these things. So, yeah, I think that's kind of what they're talking about. In terms of what does available magic look like in N'Vala? Yeah, I mean, everyone is. So it really looks like routine, I guess, because people use magic not only for, you know, making things happen, but also it's kind of a part of their practice and routine and daily routines, you know? Somebody might do a routine or ritual or spell to get them going in the morning. I mean, many people do that today. You know, I gotta have my coffee in the morning. You know, it's my ritual. You know, I sit there with my coffee and I drink my whatever. It's a form of magic. You're putting energy forth to something. So I think magic and Novala, in a lot of cases, in most cases, looks like daily routine. And it looks like a lifestyle. And it looks like, you know, things that people do every day that are part of magic, that are part of who they are. So it's not separate. It's part of something, like I said, this everyday routine for them and part of their lives. It's not these special occasion kind of things. Certain things are. I mean, it's still available to them, but, you know, they pick times and places for bigger things. But it does permeate throughout the whole of Novala.
Yeah, yeah. I like that approach to it, the idea of it could be routine. It's just, it's something that's there. And it got me thinking about the ways that I've represented that in running various levels of magic in different styles of fantasy games before. And I've actually done it in a case where, you know, where people who were like ordinary people, shopkeepers, nannies, you know, anybody and everybody had some level of basic magic that they were able to access. And whenever I would describe what it would look like, is I would always say it's like, it's very much like a special effect from the 1980s. You're pretty sure it's being done with wires. You just can't see the wires. It has a little bit of kind of puppetry movement to it. It's definitely not CG'd. Whereas if I'm running something that's far more high fantasy, where it's not, magic is not something that's in the hands of everyday people. Most of the time it's in the hands of heroes and villains. Then that's when I'll get into the more CG level of effect style. You know, it's not just that someone is launching a fireball. It's a fireball that actually has like a lion's head at the front of it kind of thing. Very big, very intense, very, very visual. So I like the idea of the availability of magic can be demonstrated in ways that go from, like you said, the very mundane is just someone just animates a broom to start sweeping a sidewalk. It's a broom. It just goes and it moves. It doesn't flip up in the air and poke itself or put itself back down into a barrel or something like that. It's just kind of does that and then just gently leans off to the side. Whereas the more flamboyant level 20 kind of magic is really big and really stupendous. And you can see the energy swirling around them. It's like a tempest. You know, you can really, your description on how you demonstrate magic happening in a game, in a world, can really come across as, you know, in a variety of ways that I think just goes to show how frequent and how common it is. Like when I talk about running Earthdawn before, because that's one, like I've said, magic permeates everything. Everybody has some kind of an access to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's still a difference between when heroes do great, powerful, noble magic. And that's one of those ways where you can allow these things to kind of express themselves a little bit. It also makes me think, my son has recently really got into Avatar The Last Airbender. And so we've been going through book one of that show. And how they demonstrate their form of magic, it's very much kind of, lots of people have access to bending, earth bending, fire bending, water bending. Obviously not air bending. We won't spoil that. but everyone else, you know, has access to it. And when you see it, you don't see this mystical energy come out of their hands, but you see that their body movements are what control it. And so it's a very unique visual way to demonstrate how magic works. You know, it's, that's the way that I kind of look at this question is, you know, like, not just what does available magic do, but what does it look like when it happens? And I think that can be used to demonstrate its power its flexibility and its applicability to the setting itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's good. I think we kind of covered that one.
Yeah. Okay.
What's the next one?
Number 6. How does it relate to the character, plot, and theme of the book? And this question right away strikes me as being almost kind of the opposite of the last question, because now we're getting into specifics, because now it's kind of like, okay, how is magic relevant to everything that's going to be happening in the fiction that we are about to unveil?
Right.
You know, it's almost never this kind of background element of just like, oh, that's cool, everyone else can do it, but not me. And then just tra-la-la on while they just do nothing but sword fighting. That doesn't happen.
Right. Right. Well, in terms of plot and story, I mean, it's kind of the pinpoint or the crux of it, the apex, you know, the balance point. Because how Nivala exists as Nivala exists as being of magic, and the people being of magic and being able to tap into that, is part of what attracts the apothecary in the first place to stay there. And the diametrically opposed way that the apothecary lived their lives, as opposed to the Nivalans. And the fact that the land itself is trying to restore balance on it using magic and using the people who to use that magic to help the land. So it really is the main part of the story, like the overarching initial point of it, you know, the inciting incident, really.
Yeah, yeah. Something dawned on me a while back, and it's just reoccurring to me now, is I remember there was at one point I thought, you know what, the magic in Nivala is almost like Princess Peach in the Mario video game series, in that it's all about rescuing them, but at the same time, too, they always leave a little something behind that's going to help you on the journey. They don't just, you know, scream for help and then they get carried off into an airship. You know, Princess Peach normally kind of leaves a little something behind, or there's something in the castle that's, oh, there's a special kind of mushroom, you'll have to use this to save her, kind of stuff. I've thought of Nivala being that, is almost like it, magic in Ironbound is almost the damsel in distress, so to speak.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because given a chance, nature, whatever nature is, will try to restore balance. You know, it tries to correct itself. You know, that's why they're called forces of nature. You know, they're things that you can't stop that happen anyway, you know, to restore a balance, to get rid of pressures, you know, not even talking about Nivala, but just talking about our planet in general. You know, earthquakes, tornadoes, and all those things, natural events that you can't stop. But those things are all about restoring balance of different kinds of pressures and different things. And even ecosystems and stuff like that. Without our interference, those things would naturally pan out. You know, those things would naturally restore themselves to what they should be, you know. And it is a balance, you know, and I like the fact that it is, because that's true to us, you know. So, I mean, there was that story I read that I know has been around for a long time about, there was the national park that had deer, right? And they just had deer, and they had no predators, no wolves, no coyotes, no anything like that. And the ecosystem suffered. It suffered a lot because the deer were just destroying everything. They were eating all the resources, and they were, you know, not, things just weren't the way they should be. The deer were destroying the environment. So what they did was they introduced wolves in there. And pretty soon things started to shift. So Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's my starting thought on it. What about yours? What about you?
No, that's interesting. First of all, that study, I've never heard of that one before. And I think that's really, that's actually really kind of fascinating in the sense of just like nature almost kind of requires some level of strife and conflict in order to actually function and continue to go. It's almost, it also makes me think too that for every calamity, like you said, nature isn't necessarily there to stop it. But at the same time too, every calamity ends up starting some kind of new recharge. So when there's a forest fire, it actually encourages new life to grow and everything like that. And in that sense, it serves a greater purpose. I like that viewpoint on it. Yeah. And it makes me think too of when it comes to magic, it makes me think of, you know, like what is the potential ripple effect that can happen when it comes to magic and how all those things happen in the story with the characters as part of the theme of the book. You know, the stories that you'll hear about magic is, you know, like in its dying days and we're starting to lose our connection with nature or the astral plane, whatever the case may be. Technology maybe is a big thing that interferes, you know, with magic in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And then having something where you've got a story, a game, a setting, or even just a single adventure where everyone is trying to go off and do something about it. There's even I can't think of the names of them, but it's, you know, it's like a lot of fantasy adventures, particularly some in like D&D and those kind of spheres, where something about magic is actually changing drastically or threatens to change.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great growing threat. There was even that there was a big adventure released a few years ago that because of some interference in magic, people could not be resurrected. So you were going into these jungles in this incredibly dangerous quest. And the thing that was like one of the backbones of D&D is like, yeah, your character will die, but don't worry. We got some spells that'll bring you back. And they were like, no, not this time. Chop, you know, and cuts it right off.
Right.
So, you know, and then it's about the ripple effects that it creates as a result of that. And then apparently from what I've heard from a few players is they started to realize, wait, does that mean that this kind of spell over here doesn't work? And then does that mean that liches can't stay alive anymore? You know, like it really kind of made people kind of stop and think of just, you know, something that is such a small change as no one can be resurrected ended up making people question so many other things about how magic function in their world. So it can really have this great ripple effect.
Yeah, balance is fragile. In all ways, it's why it's balanced, you know. You're constantly having to make adjustments. And it's not just, you know, I was talking about the coyotes and the deer, which you can look up. I think it's Yellowstone that did this. If this happened, and I'm pretty sure. And there's like a YouTube video that is about it. You know, what happens when wolves are introduced into an environment and something like that, where it talks about it. But the other thing is we are, as humans on this earth, part of that ecosystem as well, which is something that we use in Novella. The problem is we have kind of forgotten our place in that ecosystem. And so things are severely unbalanced in terms of the environment and in terms of, I mean, we know it. You know, we know we are. We have failed to maintain that balance. One example is in California, they have all these fires. You know, the fire season and wildfires and things like that. And part of that is because the Native Americans who had been there, who had been there for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years, millennia, had, you know, as part of their routine and culture and part of their place in the ecosystem, would do control burns in California.
Yeah.
When they lived there. And this helped the wildfires, kept them contained. You know, it burned off all the excess that could catch and cause vast destruction. It was controlled burns. And that was the Native Americans part in that, right? And they learned this long, long time ago, right? And so they played a part in that ecosystem. And then California, in more modern times, prevented them from doing that. And so that's part of the reason why they have so many wildfires and all of that stuff there, because they tipped the balance. They took away something that was holding balance on a certain front of the environment, and it toppled over.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's actually something that is a bit of a concern out in our area. I've got a large patch of woods that's around my property. And when I go hiking around there, I see a lot of fallen trees and dead brush and, you know, things that has not been cleared in that way. And it's really made me think, it's like, man, if a fire were to hit this area, it would hit it hard. And that's something that has been brought to attention. So, like, I live in Ontario up in Canada, and we've had quite a few large forest fires up north, nowhere near like out in the West Coast, same with California, like very, very large wildfires. But yeah, that's also been one of the things that has come about as a result of it. So, and then getting back to magic, is that sense of, is this something, specifically question six, if magic is something that has been suffering and balance has not been maintained, and now as a result, it's being corrupted, it's being weakened, it's become toxic. Is that something that the characters are able to do over the course of the story? Is this an impetus for the characters to drive them forward and all move the narrative in that direction and everything like that? I think that's a really fascinating way of doing it, of trying to save something that you would once consider to be all powerful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and in terms of novella and that, all these themes that we've been talking about apply, because what novella is about, the Ironbound are a balancing response by novella. It's part of what novella is trying to do, to restore the balance by saying, hey, you know, these beings that live upon, you know, the surface, I can give them this and they will balance out this other force that is tipping the scales, you know? And that's a big metaphor for Wicca and witchcraft in it to begin with, because the basic premise of Wicca as a religion and witchcraft is that you are part of something. You have an effect. You have a ripple effect. And part of being a witch and a Wiccan is understanding that and understanding how you can affect things, even in little ways that you affect things and can affect things. And that's the whole premise, and that we are part of the ecosystem and the way of the world. And our responsibility is to make sure we are playing our part to the best of our ability. And novella has a lot of that. You know, like the Novalans are not just separate from novella itself. We as humans are not separate from the earth. It's not just a place where we live, right? Novella is not just a place where the Novalans live. Just as this is, or earth is not just a place to live. It's something we're a part of. We are earthlings. They are Novalans. We are part of it. You know, and I think a lot of people, in a lot of ways, and a lot of bigger perspectives, the way we do things is kind of separate on that, that we are separate from it. Nature is over here and the earth is over here doing their thing, and we're over here doing our thing. And we underestimate or ignore the fact that we are also part of that ecosystem. We are apex predators. We have a place in this ecosystem as well. And we are not upholding our parts of the bargain. We're not upholding our part of the ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think that's why, if it hasn't started already, we're going to start seeing magic being used as an allegory for climate change more and more, I think. Much like in the way that cyberpunk really seemed to make a comeback, you know, as more and more billionaires seem to populate the world, cyberpunk all of a sudden started to make a bit of a comeback from the 70s and 80s, maybe 90s. I'm not much of an expert. Mm-hmm. But I feel like magic will be used to represent the climate change crisis in many ways, because I think it is a very effective allegory, because it is something that I think gets taken for granted in fantasy a lot. And it's one of the things that makes it fantastic rather than alternate history. As soon as you drop in magic, bam, fantasy. And it's always been something that's just always mm-hmm. been taken for granted. It's always there, and it's an eternal resource. Well, what if it turns out that it's not eternal? Like, what if it turns out there's only so much of this particular energy, much like there can only be so much oil within our soil, you know, for us to extract before eventually, you know, we're just basically sucking the straw dry and just making a lot of slurping noises, you know? So, and I like to see, I'm looking forward to seeing if that is the case. I'm looking forward to seeing how other people take this approach. I remember the Dark Sun campaign setting kind of did that, where magic was part of the environmental disaster. As I remember, it was the reason why Athas went from being a paradise to a desert shithole. And there were a type of magic user known as defilers who were more than happy to corrupt the land even further in order to power their magic. And that is, and this is a setting that came out in like the 1990s. So this thing alone is almost 30 years old and was already making that comparison. So I think it's one of those things where there's ripe opportunity to do it, and do it in a variety of different ways that it doesn't get stale very quickly. Like the zombie genre, that you can only have so many different reasons to come up with zombies. When it comes down to it, fungus or virus, they're zombies. They're doing the same thing.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I agree. And I think that, it's a pretty apt and pretty obvious connection to make, but I think it's important for what we chose to have in the game anyway, because we're talking about Wicca and witchcraft, how the world works and tries to get balance itself, and how Novalans feel about that, and versus how the apothecary feel about that, because they're all part of the same world, if not the same land, are two very different attitudes. And so, yeah. Let me back and did we answer fully the question, you think?
I think what we did was
the question.
Yeah, I think we kind of more so gave like a possible way of how it could relate to characters as an example, so to speak. I mean, this is definitely one of those questions: how does magic relate to the character plot and theme of the book? I think what we did was we gave one or possibly even more ways to look at how it relates to the characters, you know, by having it make it be basically
right.
If it's going to relate to the character's plot and theme of the book, then magic has become a character in the book. It has eccentricities, it has habits, it has needs, it has wants, and it does certain things when spoke in a certain way, when gestured a certain way, when invoked in a particular direction. So I think that's the main thing with this, is that you got to look at it as one of the characters in this story.
And that's something we've talked about before, that, you know, we consider Novala itself a character. It's a thing that is there and has its own purpose and all of this other stuff. But we have talked before about Novala and the land itself, which by extension, the magic, is a character in and of itself. So it affects the scene in so many ways, because in any way, it's the metaphor representative of the theme and the character anyway, because the magic is the character. So it kind of is. Is in it. How does it represent it? Well, it is. The magic is the character. The magic is the plot.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in that sense, we have answered without spending an entire episode for just that question. Because once again, I think each of these questions, we could totally do an entire episode on, But then that would be the entire premise of the show. We'd have to just start a podcast to do that and nothing.
Right. What's question 7? What's the next one then?
What is the cost of magic? And this is one that the first thing that I thought of when I read this question was, oh, okay, what's it going to cost me? You know, kind of like, what's the currency? What do you have to spend in order to make use of it? Or what's the consequence going to be, you know, for using it? And so to me, that's always been kind of almost like the negative side of it. It's like, you know, the first 6 questions are like right. All the woo and razzle dazzle and, you know, waving your fingers and sparkles coming out and everything like that. And then it comes down to 7. It's like, all right, now let's talk about the price. So first of all, I'm going to need a drop of your blood every time you go to do something like this, and you're going to feel woozy. Oh, and by the way, I own your soul, you know, kind of stuff like that.
I think the cost of it. Because in a sense, I mean, because it's available and because it's a part of the people, it's a part of the life, it's part of the routine. There aren't consequences like that. Like they have to prick their fingers or they lose a little bit of cohesion in their mind or whatever. You know, the magic doesn't work like that. However, I would say the cost, I guess, is more of a risk. It's the risk of unbalancing things by trying to balance them or by doing something you want to do. You're actually throwing things off. And then you will have to deal with the consequences of that. You know, if you aren't specific or if something happens that you didn't want it to or whatever, you know, that's running the risk whenever you use magic. It's running the risk of it not working out and then you having to deal with those consequences, you know. So that's the cost, really, is that you could unbalance things, which means that things will happen to try to balance them that you probably are not necessarily up for, right? I remember the first, like, spell that I did when I was a teenager. And it was, like, for money or something like that, I think. I'm pretty sure it was for money or a job or something or other along those lines. And, like, so I did that. And then the next week, my dad made me get a job. So, yeah, it worked. But now I have to reap the consequences of that.
Yep.
That now I have hours dedicated to going to work.
Ah, the universe works in mysterious ways.
Right. Right. I mean, what about you? What's your take on it?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it, the overall risk. I think that angle now interests me far more than it did maybe even a year ago. And from that, I mean from a design standpoint. After our last recording, I, you know, kind of got to thinking of some of this stuff in particular, because I've always been anti-magic in anything I've ever come up with before in a game on my own. I'm very much like Peter Jackson in the sense it's like, yeah, sure, I may have like $300 million to make a movie, but I don't know, magic looks weird. I don't like using it. So, but it's been one of those things where after our last episode, I remember thinking it's just like, you know, I could probably hack Pandora to be completely magic based, where they're all young, you know, witches who are going to an academy, but everything is incredibly destructive. Rather than you always start small and you work your way to the big stuff, you know, all magic just manifests as like big explosions of magic that's very catastrophic without that level of focus and control. That it's actually harder to do small doses of magic than it is to do something gigantic with absolutely, basically it's easier. It's the equivalent of driving a car without the steering wheel, and it turns out you're a NASCAR without a steering wheel. And that got me thinking then about the risks of it, and that led me to a rabbit hole of a whole bunch of other things that could be an episode unto itself. But that's an avenue that I like to look at more so. And that goes back to, I think, some of what we were talking about with question six of, you know, the cost of magic could be a long-term effect. And your story happens to be the generation that now has to deal with the consequences or potentially try to avoid the consequences. Because let's face it, most stuff that involves magic always tends to lean on the heroic side in some way, shape, or form. So it's always about trying to save and prevent and restore things back to the way that they were before, rather than wallowing in the misery of, you know, oh, we screwed up. But I like that idea of looking at it as a kind of, even if there isn't an immediate cost, then mechanically speaking, it could be one of those things where if you've got magic that has, it's easier to implement at the table, you know. It's like when we were talking with Liz and Steffi, and they were talking about how they didn't want to be magic that you had to roll to see if you could do it. They just wanted you to do it. But then the consequence that is built into their system is the repercussions of having that kind of access to magic, where it's not about whether or not it will work. It'll always work. It's a matter of whether or not you could live with the consequences, with the costs that come with doing that. And I like that approach more, because then rather than it being, ooh, what kind of modifiers could I put into this to increase my chances of successfully casting a fireball spell? I like the idea of it being more so of a conscious, almost moral choice of, I'm going to set those barrels on fire and I'm going to kill some people. I'm going to hurt people, including some of my party members. I don't think I should do this. I totally could, but I don't know if I should. And I like that idea of magic. You know, it's almost like there's a responsibility that comes with it, and things can get drastically out of hand. Which I think is a thing that when we do get to question 12, is one of those things that could kind of circle back over of what happened, you know, like it's, if magic is not taken with its due diligence, it can go very, very, very wrong. And I like that approach to magic nowadays. I find anything with something like that to be more interesting. And, you know, then, you know, always having the right verbal semantic components. Like when I used to play D&D in high school, there was always there were the three different types of requirements. There was verbal, so something had to be spoken, whatever it is. And there was semantic, which was the hand gestures normally and stuff like that. And there was another one. I can't remember. But what the heck? It's been 20 years. And so as long as, you know, like if your character would suddenly be made to go mute, well, you can't cast verbal-based spells anymore because you can't make a sound to cast a spell. Right. That was always the thing about it. We always just ended up skipping it anyways because it was like tracking weapon speed and encumbrance. It's like, I'm not here for this. I'm not here for bookkeeping. I'm not here to check off a bunch of boxes. Mm-hmm. I'm here to cast a fireball spell.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, then, shall we go to question 8?
Sure.
Because that's the opposite of question 7.
Okay.
Question 8, what can it not do?
magic can't, in Novella, you can't reverse some natural processes, like death. And people don't know, thinking about it, like how would Novalans handle that? Or you'd have a bunch of, you know, people running around, the population would get ridiculous. And then, you know, so it's part of that balance, right? And then rather than, using, you know, the magic to keep people on and stuff like that, use it to make the lives better while they're here. So I imagine there's speculation, because no one knows if the magic could do it if it wanted to, and just doesn't, or whether it literally cannot do that because of its place in the ecosystem. Interesting question to ponder. Because I think they're different questions in different contexts. I mean, because it depends. It depends on who the person is and et cetera, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think it's one of those things, if you start thinking about magic as being the answer to all the mysteries of the universe, you know, like, if it's one of those things where if you're part of a society that can do a lot of these mystical things and tap into energies that, to me, you know, would basically answer a lot of things that I think a lot of belief systems of, you know, like ancient belief systems of basically where they thought that the sun was actually a guy in a chariot running circles around the earth and stuff like this, because
right,
that was the only way that they could understand what was going on. They weren't working with the same kind of information. To me, I've always thought the use of magic implies a level of societal intelligence, of basically there has to be some level of intelligence in order to be able to use and intentionally access and direct magic in some way, shape, or form. So to me, it would almost seem right, as if, like, if you have magic and you have access to magic and it cannot do something such as bring people back from the dead, what would that do to people's belief in the afterlife, for example? Would it mean that they believe that death is this final thing where it's basically, oh, we can't bring them back because there's nothing to bring back? You know, they're gone, their soul has left their body, and that's it. You know, like, end of story. It dissipates into the wind. We can't collect it back and put it back into the body. I think that that's almost kind of a, you know, anything that you don't want your magic to do in a game setting, book, whatever, I think should also uh-huh. then go a long way to explain the society that uses it and how they view some of these really key aspects of their lives.
Right. I mean, because like I said, people don't know whether it's because it can't or whether it can and just doesn't want to. And either way, and here's the other thing. In terms of, like, something like death, let's say, Nivalens, like, it's a part of the circle, right? Like yes, you want to have your person around there with Nivalens, who maybe even attempted to keep their person around via magical means and stuff like that. But the majority of Nivalens understand that it's a part of life, right? It's not, it's a different state of being. And so using magic to go against that, you know, because we have to make room for new people. We have to make room for more ideas, and we have to keep that going, is something they understand. So the people who would attempt to do something like that, violating like that, not just death, but maybe other things, are rare. Because, you know, the people who follow the belief system understand that, you know, some of these things are things that just happen. And they're part of the cycle. And there's not really anything that you can do about it. And so magic is not used that way. So that they don't know the effects. But, you know, the few stories, I'm sure legends that go around talking about somebody who did it, you know, are sort of urban legends sort of things. And even then, there's huge consequences, even if you were able to succeed, probably. Because life and death cycle is a part of the process. So even if you could, even if they were sure that that magic could do this, it just doesn't want to because of balance reasons. It's effectively the same thing. They still can't do those things, regardless of whether it's a natural process or whether it's a lack of the magic doing these things, because some things need to happen for the benefit of everybody and the benefit of the survival of the land. So a lot of things that magic, you know, can't do are because of that. Like, I can't do this because it would unbalance the whole, it started domino effect of a whole bunch of other things. And so, you know, everything in its time and its place, you know. Is that making sense? I think.
Yeah, it does. It's almost kind of like, well, if I let your uncle come back from the dead, then I have to let everyone's uncle come back from the dead. And you know what kind of chaos right. that's going to cause? There's all these dead uncles just walking around with nothing to do.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, right. Yeah. You know, it's balancing things. You know what I mean? It's the same with, you know, culling too many animals. You know, if the Navalans were starting to use magic to, you know, make sure their hunts were super successful every single time, and they're using really powerful magic to do that, that's going to set the balance of things, you know? And so even though it can do it, you know, and to quote Jeff Goldblum, you know, just because you should doesn't mean you should, you know, just because you can. Doesn't mean you should.
Yeah.
And Novalans, hopefully, most of them. And like I said, it's not like there aren't Novalans out there who aren't selfish or grieving or anything like that, or don't see the bigger picture. Because, of course, it's people. People are different. There are going to be some that don't do that. So, you know, we'll just take that for what it is. But understand the majority of people, what Novella asks of the Novalans and what the Novalans do, is very much of balance. And so when considering what magic to do or not to do, that's always a consideration, is looking at the bigger picture of what's going on. You know, like yeah. with this, you know, example you yeah, were talking yeah. about.
I think this question also too could be a motive for the villain of the story. What's the antagonist trying to do? Because maybe the question is more, what can it not do unless X happens, or it cannot do that unless there is a full moon or a blood moon, you know, like on the 17th year since the comet fell and hit the crescent, you know, and all this kind of stuff. That can be a really good motivation for a plot of what someone is trying to do, and, you know, that could actually create like this really bad ripple effect like we've talked about before, or, you know. Yeah, I think it's you know, there's a lot of ways that this can kind of go, rather than just like, okay, so one thing I don't want to happen in this game is I don't want people to just be healing themselves left, right, and center. We're trying to keep this as a gritty setting, so wounds should matter. Wounds should have an impact, and you should have them for a while, and you have to find a way to overcome them. So I don't want healing magic. You know, like in most times I find whenever there's any kind of limitation on that, it's simply because it doesn't really fit the aesthetics of the game. It doesn't fit the narrative and the style that you're trying to go for. It can be a really good way to look at what would someone try to do, though, if they thought they could. Like, it makes me think of the movie Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Where Kingpin tries to bring back his wife, his family, and look what happens as a result of, because you can't do that. But the extreme right. that he goes to try is what creates a story.
Right. And that could very easily be a Novalan story. It very easily be something that is in the game somehow. Somebody trying to do something that magic was meant. And the good part about the magic system of Novella is that it's vague enough that we don't have those parameters, right? Like, we wanted to strive for something that could be tailored, you know, strive for something that could be custom made, and it wouldn't really constrain you to a certain extent. Like, you know, I can do a fireball. It has a 200 foot range. It does this much damage. If I add this, then it does even more damage. If this happens, it does less, you know, very specific numbers and very specific restrictions. And our magic system in Novella doesn't really have that. And to be clear, I'm not dissing, you know, D&D or other games that have these very specific things. Sometimes it fits right for the game, and you need to do what's right for the game. And the type of game that people want to play or are playing when they are wanting to play when they pick up your game. But ours is such that, like, what can't it do? is sort of that, like you said, it's a weird question because our Novala is so kind of free form in terms of the energy and magic, what it can and can't be used for. It's really a matter of how it works out, right? And balance in the game itself and the storyteller running the game and the players. Like, between them, what do they decide is the limit of this? Or what do they decide are the consequences of doing these things? Are they always the same? You know, that's kind of up to those folks to decide if that's something they want to do or not.
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe one thing when it comes to Novala that you can't do with magic is you can't take it and try and use it as fuel. Or, like, you can, but you shouldn't. And if you try, then this is what's going to happen. So it's almost like you can't take it and you can't corrupt it for your own personal selfish gains, you know, like to basically because you don't want to walk or you don't like horses, you know, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it makes me think, too. And I might start playing around with this in my game of Ironbound, that what if the apothecary had heard about this powerful magic that existed in Novala, and they had heard legends from, say, sailors who travel to the distant lands and everything, of a people that could make a tree grow within minutes. And then that becomes a game of telephone that just gets wildly out of control. And by the time it reaches someone with the resources to send a party of apothecary scouts ahead to check it out, they have heard that this has powerful healing magic that can make you live forever. And so all of a sudden it's like, well, that's a place that we got to go check out. And off they go for their own, you know, nefarious purposes. I kind of like that idea of, you know, that's maybe what they heard when they first started to travel, this myth that was completely inaccurate, but based on a real thing.
Right.
Because that's never happened in history.
No, of course not. Of course not. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. but I think that's the answer, really, is to say that it's not that it can't do something. It's more like it won't, or the person doesn't have the wherewithal, or there are consequences that get felt for doing those things. So it's not like it's just completely like magic doesn't do that. You know what I mean? It's a lot like the genie in Aladdin.
Yeah.
Right? And he gives the three rules, the three things he can't do.
Yes.
Three things, three rules that he has. No wishing for more wishes, no falling in love, and no raising people from the dead. And how he says that in Robin Williams' voice is, it's not a pretty picture. I don't like doing it. So the implication is the genie can and probably has, but this is a restriction that he has put on his own magic. You know, even though he has infinite cosmic power, he has put these restrictions on it because of what people have done with it and own boundaries and things like that.
Yep. Well, and even then, too, his powers can't allow him to free himself. Someone has to wish for it. And, of course, obviously nobody ever does. Mm-hmm. But that's the part that Jafar doesn't think about. He just thinks about the all cosmic power.
Yeah.
And then as soon as he gets it, barely has for a fraction of a second, and then
right.
gets sucked up inside his lamp. And then that's it. End of story until the direct-to-video sequel.
Right. So in that case, yeah, there's a restriction there. Like, don't wish to be a genie. But it's not like it can't happen. It's just people who thought about it before went, wait a minute, that's not worth it. You know, that's not going to be worth it in the end for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it's a restriction. You know, you don't do that. But it's not because you don't do it because it can't happen. It's you don't do it because of the result and the consequences you'd have to take for doing such a thing. So, yeah, I think that's kind of that. Answer to that. And funnily enough, do you have anything else to add to that?
Just that I love the fact that we use Robin Williams to help explain magic and what it can and cannot do to people. As someone who actually cried when we found out that he passed away, and the only time I've ever had a celebrity.
That really upset me, honestly. I didn't expect that one to hit me so hard, honestly. But I heard it. And you know, I mean, I'd heard of celebrities dying before. You know, it wasn't anything, you know, that hadn't happened in my life. I think the first one I remember really knowing was Jim Henson. That I truly remember thinking something about somebody that I knew, quote unquote, as a celebrity, was Jim Henson. But then Robin Williams, so many years later, I mean, hit me, you know, like none of the other ones had before. For some reason, it did that to a lot of people, But the genie is an example of what I mean by, you know, it's not necessarily a restriction in power. It's a restriction of consequences and boundaries and balance and all of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because genie has cosmic power. Do whatever the heck the genie wants.
Yeah. Finally, the last thing for me is I like the fact how we've been talking about balance, but by no means we are talking about game mechanic balance. Like when you hear people say, oh, everything has to balance, which, you know, depending on what it is, you know, can be more true than other cases. But yeah, that's not necessarily, you know, like what we're talking about is more like setting balance, you know, like what keeps everything in check and keeps one thing from dominating over everything else. And if that's not the case, then why? And everything else like that. And it's all, I think all these four questions we tackled today really kind of encapsulate kind of like the, okay, so we've established in the first four questions what it is, what it does. But now we're going to get into some slightly deeper thoughts about its purpose and function within the world and what we actually do with it.
Right. And I can easily see as part of a tool, you know, a guide, someone who's running a game would use in Ironbound is that idea of the players or characters or NPCs doing something and thinking through the ramifications of it, the ripples. How does Nevala respond? How do other people respond? And that being something that is considered as a moral quandary or a question or a problem to deal with. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Cool. Other than that, I think once again, we really did some magic with these four questions.
We did. Yeah. And it's just about 1 hour again. So, for sure. So I imagine next time we'll finish up the last four questions talk about those.
Yes. And especially, too, I'm looking forward to our discussion on the last question. I'm not going to spoil it. So if you haven't seen the list.
I have not.
Question number 12 is the one that I am really looking forward to getting into. So we'll speed through 9 to 11 and focus on 12.
Indeed. All right, cool. Anything else before we sign off for this episode?
No, I think we've got this one covered. I think we're good.
All righty then. Well then, as always, everyone, thank you for listening. If you have anything else to add, you know, want to go back, get a list of the questions, add one of your own, talk about your own magic systems, feel free to let us know. We have Discord. And of course, Twitter and social media, you can contact us on as well. So please do so. And until then, I wish you a little magic in your gaming and a little gaming in your magic.
The Covenstead Podcast was created and produced by Daniel Delisle and Todd Crapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out. Special thanks to all of our backers, Alex, Tim Brandon, Chris Atrata, Century Guild, Nicholas Diak, Fool's Moon Entertainment,
Kaboom.com. Minus five O's, no apologies. Brian P. Kurtz, Jason LaDuke, Civ Light, Revna, Derek Simsek, Danielle Thomas, Phil Watson, Jacob Wood, and Victor Wyatt. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.